You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
It's Mike Shope and the Bulldog.
Mike and I will hope that his 10 golfers break their legs.
On WGR Sports Radio 550.
I don't want Mike's name on that. I feel bad now. I'm a jerk. I say that. He winces every time I say something like that. And now his name is on it. I feel a lot of guilt. I don't feel good about it. Mike is supposed to, we're going to call him. Brian Koziel's already on the AT&T hotline. Sal Capaccio's here and has been here all afternoon. I am the Bulldog. Thank you for tuning in. It's Majors Pick 10 time. That's the official name of this, right, Brian? Pick 10?
I like it. I think we should brand it and sell it.
I feel like I've seen the hashtag Pick 10 attached to this.
Yeah.
how are you, anyway?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Sal played Grover today.
Yeah, Sal, I heard Jeremy's back going on the golf train. He told me that his quest to break 80 is back on, and I know Sal's been playing a ton of golf, so I think the guys at the station are enjoying the weather right now, definitely.
Quest to break 80. I mean, that would be it. I had a chance a couple weeks ago at Chestnut Hill. I went to the last hole needing par, but I wound up with a triple, and I had an 81. So I was really happy but mad. But, man, that's not – my quest is to make sure I don't want to go over 90. I've been in the 80s lately, and I want to make sure I stay there. You know what I mean?
It's so hard, too, because, I mean, you're when you're shooting that score or whatever your goal is, like – you're adding it up as you go. I mean, it's tough to just say, well, I'm going to forget about the score.
But, right.
I mean, you definitely, especially if you feel like if you're playing well, you definitely know what you have. Like, I know that people say, oh, just don't think about it. Like, you know what you have.
Usually, yeah.
I do.
I'm not sure if
I don't
know what we have at the golf tournament.
I don't mind keeping track. I like to keep pace because my goal is if I try to play bogey golf and then I can pick up a few strokes here or there. So I try to tell myself after three holes, all right, I'm on track or I'm not on track.
Right.
And that's how I like to figure it out. But you're right. I mean, for most people, you know, thinking about it, it's a distraction. I actually enjoy kind of thinking about it along the way.
I don't have enough experience being low enough to care. That's what my problem right. is, so I usually lose track. It's what usually happens to me. Let's bring Mike Shope in, who's been enjoying some time away, but is here to participate in Brian's selection of his 10 golfers. Mike, how you been?
Good, and I haven't even paid Brian yet from the last one of these.
Oh, geez.
That's what makes this one a little more sweeter for me. I know I'm playing with house money.
Right.
Well, there is that. Yes, there is that. Are you enjoying yourself?
Yes, I have to tell you what I just saw. You're the first person I'd want to tell this to, and now I'm telling you.
Oh, excellent.
I was just at the Stone Pony.
Oh, dude, wow. That's pretty cool. I've never been. I've never been to Asbury Park. I've never been to that part of the shore. That's fantastic. Was there anybody? Was Bruce there?
No, I didn't see anybody. Ben Folds and Cake played on Sunday, and Band of Horses, which was a Balk band, as I remember it, was there Saturday. And then right next to that is this Asbury Convention Hall, and that's got Buddy Guy on Sunday, John Cleese on Friday night. That's interesting. Adam Ant this weekend, too.
Wow, really cool. All right. Did you just go in there for a drink, or did you, like, what was it, a tourist thing? Like, what was going on there?
It's right behind the boardwalk on the ocean, so
all
you
right.
can just look at it as a
awesome,
you know, what a landmark almost in a way.
All right, well, I'm envious. I've never, like I said, I've never been to that part of the shore, and I would want to check that out. So, Brian, what are you thinking about here? I did see conditions appear to be really dry. Is that right?
Yeah, the course is going to look baked out on TV. And I know for some, they don't like that about the Open Championship, but, I mean, it's just, they don't doctor up the course. The R&A, the way they set it up over there, I mean, they just, other than keeping the greens, you know, in condition to putt on, if it doesn't rain and the fairways get baked out and the rough doesn't grow, they just let it be. They just, you know, they're not concerned mm-hmm. necessarily with a winning score like the USGA does with their setup for the U.S. Open. So, yes, it's very baked. It's very brown. It probably won't look super picturesque on TV. I've been hearing guys in practice rounds that are hitting like 5 irons off the tee and it rolling like 100 yards plus after it lands. I guess Tiger said he hit a 5 iron, which for him, he says, normally is somewhere, you know, in the 230, 240 range. And he said that it went 333 when they stepped it off just because of the roll. So I've heard guys that are shorter hitters. Brant Snedeker said in his practice round he hit a 427-yard drive, and Snedeker is not a long hitter at all.
Oh my God.
So
come on.
The ball is going to roll. Tiger said, I was listening to his press conference yesterday, he said he thinks the ball in the middle of the fairways where it's crowned is rolling faster than it actually is on the greens. And the British Open greens normally are slower. They're not at the pace that the U.S. Open is or like they are at Augusta. So I could believe it, and I think we're going to see some crazy shots end up in some weird stuffs, whether it, you know, they end up rolling into pot bunkers or into some different lies or some things like that. But yes, you're correct. It's dry. It's crispy. It's going to be a kind of a different one than we're used to seeing from the rest of the majors.
Yeah, I saw just a little GIF on Twitter of someone dropping a ball onto what they claimed was a fairway from like waist high, and the ball hit the ground and it made like a sound you'd hear like off gravel and bounced almost right back up to the guy's hand. I thought, like, okay, wow. Well, that's hard. it's not soft at all. Are the greens going to be soft?
I think those are. I mean, from the pictures of the practice round and the video, they do look like they're still receptible. The greens normally at the British Open they run slower in terms of putting on, but a lot of times you see guys bounce it in because they're not as receptive as you see like on a normal PGA Tour event in the States. But I'm not sure if they're going to maybe water them extra just so that doesn't get out of hand as well. But, you know, that part, at least of the course, will look green. And I think guys will be able to kind of do what they want about the green, around the green. The strategy, I think, that's interesting is what was part of what my line of thinking goes with picking guys is that Tiger says, I don't know how much I'm going to hit driver, if at all. He says he's putting his 2-iron in his bag, the shot that, of course, he was a master at back in the heyday. He hit that little stinger, and it would run forever. Mickelson said, I don't even know if I'm going to carry driver. But now I'm hearing from some of the guys that like to hit driver, like Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka and Rory McIlroy, they said because it's so dry, they're going to be enticed to hit driver more. And the reasoning is not necessarily the length, but because it's been so dry and there's been no rain, the rough areas, the fescue areas, it's not thick. They said it's very thin and wispy, and they said it's not really a penalty. They feel like they can get out of there. So I guarantee you, you're going to see somebody at some point based upon roll, and you're going to see these 450-plus yard drives. And, you know, some of these guys might be enticed to just keep hitting driver because if they go into the fescue stuff, it's might not going to be as penalizing as it would have been in years past.
How low could we get? Could we get someone to 20 under here for this thing, or is that crazy?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, Carnoustie normally, of the rotation for the Open Championship courses, plays as one of the toughest. They've had winners in the past be over par, but I mean, I think you're right. I think we're going to see somebody's going to at least get to double digits, if not more. I think under par this week.
Yeah,
I mean this course hasn't played easy in the past, but I just think with the conditions, I think it's going to be good for better scoring. I mean, for those that, you know, if you're thinking, well, you know, what's different about this course? It does play harder. Probably the memory that I'm guessing all four of you or all three of us here, if you remember Carnoustie 1999, probably the most famous one is when John Vandeveld had the lead. He was all he needed was a double bogey going to 18, and he hit driver, and it was a mess, and he ends up in the burn. He took his shoes off and rolled his pants up and eventually had to get an amazing up and down out of the sand just to make the playoff. He ended up losing to Paul Laurie, but and then, of course, it was there in 07, Harrington beat Garcia in a playoff when Garcia was kind of winning for most of the time, and Harrington kind of got in and won the playoff. But when I think of Carnoustie, I immediately have that image of Vandeveld,
yeah,
pants rolled up, sitting in that burn on 18 realizing, like, what an idiot I am.
Right. It's, as soon as you say his name, you can totally see him with the pants rolled up. Mike, do you think, what would you do here? Like, do these conditions that Brian is describing make it harder, you think, to pick 10 guys? Like, it seems like someone random could win this thing.
Yes. I think Brian should pick all long shots. I think he should have to pick Vanderbilt because he said he should have to pick someone ridiculous and, you know, at least one of those guys. Make it interesting.
Well, Brian, what do you think?
All right, well, as Mike would want me to do, I, of course, checked to see who the betting favorites are first, and I've got seven of...
I would want to do that myself, but I don't want you to do that. No.
Well, that's true.
I want you to pick your list based on former champions at that golf course only.
Paul Laurie and Patrick Harrington.
He would want you to call Mike Ditka and ask him who he thinks you should pick is what he would want you to do.
Let me hear Christy O'Connor Jr. in here on this list somewhere.
Well, I've based upon the betting favorites, I've narrowed down my list, and I believe I've got seven of the top 10, and I just think some of them I just have to take. Dustin Johnson, he's the number one favorite. He's 12-1. I think no matter what the conditions are, I don't care. He has to be a selection. Then from there,
excuse me, by the way, to Bulldog's question, because I was joking, but I think 12-1 may be high for a favorite.
I think you're right.
And if that's right, then I think the logical extension of that is that this tournament is seen as being more wide open. But I'm not, like, I don't have that catalog or anything. I don't know if that's true. I feel like at the U.S. Open, whoever it was, Johnson or whoever it was a smaller favorite than the one. And maybe there were a few guys lower than that.
I think that's right, and the same was true for the Masters, if I recall. 12-1 does seem high.
Yeah, I think kind of like the 7-8-1 range is usually what the top guy is for these other majors that we've done. So I think you're right. So Dustin Johnson is definitely amongst the 10. But to your point, Mike, there was a whole bunch of names that I know that we always consider that are like in the mid-20s to 30-1 range. Spieth, Koepka, Thomas, Stenson, Garcia, Day, Reed, Rahm, they're all kind of between 22-1 and 35-1, and there's a whole big clump of them. And that's kind of where I really had my difficulty. The guys that I definitely had no doubt about, like, were on my list the second I was writing this down. Dustin Johnson is one. Justin Rose is two. He always plays well in this event. And I think being familiar, too, with the course itself, he's definitely there. The second betting favorite is actually Fowler, who I actually really like this week. If I was going to pick one, I think I might go Fowler anyway. He says he likes putting on slow greens. He had a top 10 last week at the Scottish Open. At some point, he's got to win one. I just feel like the law of odds here are going to go in his favor at some point. So he's my third. Fleetwood has been playing very, very well as of late. Of course, remember he had the 63 at the U.S. Open that almost got him in to get the win on Sunday. When the European Tour has their event schedule, they actually have a regular event at Carnoustie, and Fleetwood's had a good record there too. So I thought he was a no-brainer. So that's four. And then I come to that big clump. I got McIlroy, Rahm, Woods, Spieth, Koepka, Thomas, Stenson, Garcia, Day, Reed. Like, they're all in the mid-20s to lower 30s-1 range. I'm going to give you guys McIlroy. I'm going to pass on Rory, who actually is the fifth best. He's 20-1. I just think from watching his game this year, it's very inconsistent. I know that when he's hot, he can run away with a tournament. So I'm a little, as I'm talking it out here, I feel kind of silly leaving him off the list because he's the fifth highest betting favorite here. But I'm not taking McIlroy. I just think he's been too inconsistent this year. You want me to keep going?
Sure. You said you had four. I've got DJ, Fowler, and Fleetwood written down. Who did I miss?
And Rose.
Rose. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Koepka is number five for me. Just playing great. I think if it does turn into a who can hit the ball the farthest because the ball's rolling forever, I like him in the mix. He seemed to be a guy that also seems to be now making clutch putts. That was what I was really impressed by at the U.S. Open. Probably the hottest golfer in the world is Francesco Molinari from Italy. In his last five starts, he's had two wins and two second places. So I feel like maybe that's a name we normally don't pick.
Mm-hmm.
So Molinari is in. Justin Thomas at 25-1 is also on my list. He's just too talented. I feel like he can win at any point when he's on his game. So he's in. I'm passing on Rahm, who would kind of be next up in that betting list. Rahm is off my board. He's just had, I think, a too inconsistent of a year, so I'm not taking him.
Good.
That gets me to eight, I believe. Is that correct, Bulldog?
I've got DJ, Fowler, Fleetwood, Rose, Koepka, Molinari, Thomas. That's seven.
Seven. Okay, so I have three left. And this is where my debate came in. Alex Noren, who in his last start at the French Open a few weeks ago, he won. Stenson plays well in this tournament. Garcia plays well in this tournament. Day has been close to winning this tournament before, but I'm passing on all of them, and it brings me to Woods. And I think if Tiger is going to win a major, it's here. He doesn't have to hit driver because of the fact that in his other tournaments, he's had chances to win down the stretch. He's taken quite a bit of penalty strokes off the tee. So that variable goes away. He also hasn't been putting wonderfully, but I wonder with these slower greens if it'll kind of maybe wipe that out a little. So I know this could be me rooting for an interesting story, but I think if he's going to win a major or when his next major comes, I think the open venues are the best for him. So I'm taking Woods as pick eight. Stenson, Garcia, Day, Reed, I'm going to pass on all of them. I'm going to go with Jordan Spieth. I don't like how he's playing. I don't think he's going to win, but I feel like I have to take him because if he wins and I don't have him, I'm going to be very mad at myself because I like his game quite a bit. I love how he prepares for majors. He thrives on the pressure. He showed he knows how he can play these courses. So Spieth is my ninth. And then I'm going to go way, way, way down the board, 66-1 for my last pick, and I'm going with Zach Johnson.
Tom Watson.
Yeah. He's second in the tour in terms of approach shots inside 150. I know that's an obscure stat, but I was trying to come up with something statistical to bring to the table here for kind of the wild card pick. If it becomes so dry that distance is meaningless, from 150 in, Zach Johnson is second on the PGA Tour. He's won a British Open before, so I'll make Zach Johnson pick number 10.
He won a British Open and won me one of these bets.
That's right.
In the process. So, well,
every golfer.
What's that?
Has Brian named every?
Yes.
Yeah, I might have. So here's
he was thorough.
You could hear it here. I mean, the French Open is a tennis tournament. It's a good move not to pick that guy.
That's right. But your field has some nice names that we normally pick. Like you guys get Rory, you get Rahm, you get Garcia, you get Day, you get Reed, you get Stenson. So you have Mickelson as well. So
very happy.
And Watson.
And you have Tom Watson and Bubba Watson. You get them both.
Both Watson.
All right, good. Well, the pressure's on because the field has won both of these, right? I didn't win when I picked my seven at the Masters, and Mike, you didn't have Koepka in the U.S. Open, right?
Right, because no one wins two in a row.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, so
looked it up.
The picker is 0 for 2.
Right.
So we'll see if we can buck that trend here.
Well, thanks for doing this, Brian. And Mike, thanks for making yourself available during your time off. Enjoy the rest of the break, and we'll catch up soon.
Thank you.
All right.
Brian. I mean, not really. Good luck, Bulldog.
Yes.
good luck to you too, Mike.
Thank you, gentlemen. Good
All right.
luck to me.
Brian, yes, thank you. That's Brian Koziol on the AT&T hotline along with Mike Shope. I'm trying to figure out why I made you sit here through all this. Sal's just sitting here.
I could be home by now, probably. I would tell you that.
It's not funny, really. I am sorry.
So, give me a moment, though. because I have actually done the research now, and I was wrong a little bit. I've been reading up on the history of this, the golf course and the U.S. Open and Grover and all that. So here, kind of a mix of what I've told you. Okay. The course was founded as the Country Club of Buffalo in 1889, and it was originally where it's the intersection of Elmwood and Nottingham, where Delaware Park and Buff State basically is, right? Then, because of the Pan Am Expo, they did actually move it to where it is now, and it did host the U.S. Open there.
Okay.
So, it was a mix of the things I was saying. So, that is where it was held, where it is now. Good. But it was originally, and then the Country Club of Buffalo now is, of course,
out in Williamsville.
Of course. So, there you go. That's
all right, good.
The history I was looking
Very
for.
Very thorough. All right, good deal. All right, let's get back on track here. One of the big stories in football this week has been what's going on with the Steelers and Le'Veon Bell. We will get you an update on that from... on the ground in Pittsburgh. Andrew Filipponi, our old buddy from WGR, works at 93.7 The Fan in Pittsburgh, and he joins us after this on WGR.
It's Mike Shope.
We were having a very serious conversation about mayonnaise here.
And the Bulldog.
And don't even talk to me about weed.
On WGR, Sports Radio 550.
Like that open really captures the spirit of the thing. Like I like that. I like that one a lot. Glad to have you with us here on a Wednesday afternoon. Sal is in for Mike Shope this afternoon. I am the Bulldog. Thanks for hanging. And on the AT&T hotline right now is our old buddy from Pittsburgh, Andrew Filipponi, 93.7 The Fan in Pittsburgh. Andrew, good afternoon, my man. How are you?
Bulldog, I hate mayonnaise.
Well, let's... That's a good thing to hate because it's not good for you. So good call.
I'm one of those guys that if I go someplace and there's mayonnaise on the sandwich, I want to, like, give it back and say, like, make me another one. But I'm also very passive-aggressive about those kinds of things. So I usually just complain to my wife about it and end up eating it. But ultimately, I don't know about you, but I have a hard time, like, if I go out to eat, giving food back.
Right. Yeah. No, my wife loves when I get upset about things that I'm not going to do anything about.
Yes.
That's one of her all-time favorite. Like,
yes.
Oh, good. He's going to sit here and bitch about this for the next 45 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I've got that down to a mastery.
Yep.
I've got
good.
That down
wow,
to a
you, you've not been married that long, so good job. You made good progress. So Did Le'Veon Bell do the Steelers a favor by not accepting the 5-year, $70 million contract? Like, how do you view what's going on with Le'Veon Bell and the Steelers, Andrew?
Yeah, I was ecstatic when he didn't sign that deal because I'm of the opinion that even though his agent says that he's a multi-threat player, that he's like this new age or new type of running back, which is ridiculous. Marshall Faulk had a 100 catch season, and David Johnson had more catches 2 years ago and had more yards 2 years ago than what Bell did in 2017. So he's trying to say that his client is one of a kind, and that's just not entirely true.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think that running backs are built to last forever, especially one that has considerable baggage like Bell. So they haven't won a Super Bowl with him. You could make the argument they really haven't come that close. And I'd rather go back into the draft and get a young running back who costs me like $4 or $5 million a year if you take him in the first round or the second round and try to put more money into their defense. So I don't want to invest all my money into the offense, and I also don't want to invest a lot of money into a running back.
There's also the little tidbit about how they're at least – as good, if not actually better offensively when he has not been in the lineup, which is kind of weird. And it's not just like one or two games. And we're talking about, I think it's like 18 games or so. Is that the number?
So the last 16 games they've played without him, their record in those games is 11-5. And in 2015, when he got injured at the halfway point of the season, Vontaze Burfict took him out. And he was done for the year. D'Angelo Williams went in at running back, and he had 11 touchdowns that season. And the offense as a whole finished fourth in scoring. The only three teams that were better were the Panthers, who had the MVP, Cam Newton, Arizona, who had the runner-up in the MVP, Carson Palmer, and the Patriots. So they were really no worse for wear without him. And if you look at the last 2 years, I think, is the range here, the last 2 years of data, when he's in the lineup versus when he's not in the lineup, their yards per game is like 1 or 2 yards of difference. Like, it's very minimal, his effect overall on the offense when he's in versus when he's out.
Hey, Andrew, it's Sal Capaccio. How are you?
Hey, Sal. What's up, man?
Hey, so I'm interested in the whole dynamics of just the Steelers organization, how they've treated things in the past. They've always seemed to be a team that never likes to spend really big money. They don't go out and sign a lot of free agents. They're very good at home-growing talent and then retaining their own. Even for them, though, this salary seems really high for them to be able to swallow. So from their perception and their angle of things, you know, where is this playing out and where is it ultimately going?
So from their vantage point, I think that one of the core beliefs that they have is they don't guarantee money beyond the first year. So even if you look at Antonio Brown's first season, like, and that would have been last year on a new contract, the only money that was guaranteed was the $19 million that he made in his first year. So I'm almost positive, but for salary cap purposes, they basically took his entire salary last year and made it into a signing bonus. So he got like $17 or $18 million up front, and then like the $1 million that was left over got spaced out over the 17-week season, and they were willing to give Bell $10 million in a signing bonus, and then I don't know the complete breakdown of his contract, but like, let's say he was going to make $16 million in his first year. Well, then the $6 million, so 10 plus 16, $16 million salary, 10 would be a signing bonus and 6 would be what he made over the 17 weeks of the season. And they weren't going to budge that far from that. So they weren't going to make an exception to a rule. When guys have contracts, when they're under contract, they don't negotiate with them on a new deal until that player is going into the last year. So they won't rip up a contract with like 2 or 3 years left and give a guy a new one. That's another one of their core principles. I think one of the things that I disagree with them on is, I think even with this offer, they were ready to kind of break, from the NFL trend of not giving running backs a premium salary. They were ready to give him, I think Ian Rappaport reported, $33 million in the first 2 years of this deal, which is an average of $16.5 million, which is more than double what the next highest paid running back is making.
So is this the last season in a Steelers uniform for Le'Veon Bell?
100%, yes, 100%. I say that because if they were to franchise him next year, that would be the average salary for the top 5 highest paid quarterbacks. There's no way that happens.
Right.
And the other thing they could do is transition tag him. So, like, not to go too inside football here with you guys, but so the transition tag would mean you take, I think it is, he gets another like percentage bump in salary. So that would take him from about $14.5 million to $17 million next year. But with the transition tag, It's like you can make a guy an offer sheet with a restricted free agent in hockey. Like, every team would be able to make an offer to him, and there's no way a team wouldn't. Like, even if it was like 4 years at $40 million, that'd still be more than the $17 million that they were going to pay him in the first year. So I don't think there's any way that they would retain him unless the market just wasn't there for him and they felt like they were getting a bargain on him, which I don't think is going to happen.
Take a break. More of our conversation with Andrew Filippone coming up after this on WGR. Talking with former WGR staffer. You like that? Staffer. Andrew Filippone, he's at 93.7 The Fan in Pittsburgh now. How is this going over with fans? Like, are they siding with the Steelers. My sense in these situations in Buffalo has usually been when a player wants more money, the fans always side with the team. It's always curious to me, but we always end up, I think, just deciding that the player's being a greedy jerk and that the team is in the right. How's it going in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I think that it's pretty comparable. I remember when I was with you guys like 10 years ago and the whole Jason Peters thing happened, right. And he was like a pariah in Buffalo. And that's a left tackle compared to one of the, you know, top players overall in the entire league. So I think you've got it right, Chris. I think what happened here, what worked against him, is that he had like the things behaviorally that you ask out of a player, like you ask somebody if they're going to try to like set the market or break the bank, can they get like the little things right? Can they conduct themselves professionally on social media? No, Val doesn't do that. The day before they played the Jaguars in the playoffs, he said he couldn't wait to play New England. He had already, you know, acted like the game the next morning or the next afternoon, I should say, was like in the bag and a guarantee. So that irritated people. He's gotten suspended for not just, you know, it's not just failing drug tests. It's the fact that he got arrested for driving high on his way to a preseason game. So he was high on his way to work. That didn't go over well. It's the fact that he's, like, in rap songs because he thinks he has this burgeoning hip-hop career. He's talked about how, like, the fans have turned against him and has kind of made them into the villain in all of this. So, you know, and then, like, one more thing, which is maybe the most important thing, is that he didn't show up to practice the day before their playoff game. So, like, the things that, you know, if he was just a 1,500-yard back and had a monster season last year, I think that there would be fans here who said, you know what, just give this guy his money. He's a really good player. We're in the business of keeping really good players. But I do think that there's, like, a malignant or, like, cancerous cloud that fans here think hangs over this guy, and they kind of look at him as maybe not worth the trouble. So I think right now we've reached a point where the vast majority of fans say, good riddance, we're going to like ride the wheels off you this year, and then good luck playing for the New York Jets or the Cleveland Browns next year.
So, yeah, how does this year play out then? Just like last year, like he shows up at the end of training camp in time to get ready to play the opener, and yeah. Like is it an uneasy marriage, or is everybody just going to be professional and it's fine?
Well, that, yeah, I think it all depends on like who yeah, I think with the coach, I think Tomlin has always been a very vocal supporter of him, even going back to his rookie year. He loves Bell, so I don't think that this is going to create a chasm or a schism between him and his coach, number one.
Okay.
I don't think that his teammates have turned on him through this process. You know, even though the majority of guys in that locker room can't comprehend making like $15 million a year and might be put off by the fact that somebody would say no to that, I think like Roethlisberger is probably his biggest ally. Ben has said numerous times that he thinks that Bell, even more so than Brown, is responsible for the success they have on offense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it kind of trickles down from there. If the quarterback believes in this guy and isn't going to hold this against him, then I don't think that there's an issue in the locker room. I do think what you have the potential for, though, is if he's either not having a good season or they're riding him too hard, then I think that there could be, you know, the business interest of football could take over. And that's where, mm-hmm. you know, you don't want this kind of hanging over you going into a make-or-break season. So I am kind of interested in how that plays out. If he's getting too many carries, is he nervous that that's going to negatively affect him when he goes into free agency? And if he's just not effective, well, then is he going to say, give me the ball more because I need the stats to get the money that I want.
Right. And almost any injury that he suffers at all, if it costs him any time, will probably be looked at skeptically. We went through this with Jarris Byrd who had a foot issue and came back and played on a franchise tag, and it was just, you know, oh, he's just preserving himself. He's not really hurt. He just wants to make sure he's okay to hit the market. So like, you probably will get some of that if he has the usual running back, you know, hamstring tightness or whatever, you know, the kind of travails that a running back, you know, usually goes through during a grueling football season.
Yeah, I think it is a little bit different than last year, because he was on the franchise tag last season. He played all 16 games and plus the playoff games. But I think he probably knew, and his agent had probably told him, that there was a chance that he was going to get franchise tagged again because the dollar figure wasn't prohibitive. And now we're to a point where he knows that he is, barring some unforeseen event, he will be a free agent. Like, he can see that light at the end of the tunnel. I think that's why Adam Schefter, probably from the agent, is a leveraging tactic, floated out there 2 days ago that Bell would consider taking his holdout into the season from a preservation standpoint of what's most valuable for me might be my health and not necessarily the production I have this year.
Yeah, we're used to dealing with Adisa Bakari here in Buffalo because he is Tyrod Taylor's agent as well, and when going through all of that stuff with him, and he's interesting the way he goes about his business and some of the things and some of the rhetoric he uses sometimes. Andrew Filippone, 93.7 The Fan in Pittsburgh. By the way, our sister station, now we're all one family there with 93.7
CBS.
The Fan, CBS and Entercom. Andrew, Ben Roethlisberger, is this all done now? Are we not talking about retirement and what the future holds beyond this year anymore? And on to that note, what is his relationship with Mason Rudolph after everything that happened after the draft?
So to answer the first part of your question, I think that there's a good chance that he signs another contract with this team. He has 2 years left on his current contract, 2018, 2019. Barring some kind of concussion that makes him think about his cognitive and mental state at the end of the year, even if he were to suffer like a broken ankle that cost him like half a season, I don't think that would be enough to force him into retirement. So I believe he'll sign. Maybe he'll give a little bit of money back to the team to allow them to make more moves, but I think he'll sign a deal between 2018 and 2019 that pays him around $30 million a season. So I think we'll probably have conservatively 3 years of Roethlisberger, possibly five. And I think the Rudolph thing now, people who are around minicamp are trying to like turn it back into a non-story. Well, you know, Ben was frustrated after the draft. He made those comments tongue in cheek. He wasn't serious. You know, he was at practices in minicamp and was very receptive to questions. And he also would give Rudolph unsolicited advice. But, you know, I think when there's no pressure on in May and, you know, you're months away from the start of the season, I think that's the time where it's easy to be friendly and cordial towards a guy who was drafted to take your job. I'll put it this way. If Ben gets off to the same start he did last year, which frankly was not very good, he had that five interception game in there against Jacksonville in October. I can't see him spending time on a Monday or a Tuesday in a film room or in a quarterback room trying to help Mason Rudolph. So I think it's TBD. I think it's to be determined. I think Ben is very, prideful. I think he's very protective. He wants to be this team's quarterback for a long time. I don't think he wants to groom the usurper. So I think it'll be very touch and go between them. And just one note on that, guys. The Steelers didn't hire a quarterback coach this offseason, which to me is like one of the more mind-boggling decisions by the organization. They have an inside linebackers coach. They've got quality control coaches up the wazoo. And you'd think with four viable quarterbacks, Dobbs is in his second year, their third stringer from Tennessee, and with drafting Rudolph, that they would want a guy to like spend extra time with them in a quarterback room. But no, they don't. They've got an offensive coordinator who doubles as a quarterback's coach, who they're asking basically to be in two places at once.
That is a little weird. Is that so that Roethlisberger doesn't have to watch a quarterback's coach groom his replacement? Like, is that the inference here?
The inference is they hated Todd Haley and that they needed to promote the quarterback's coach to offensive coordinator, but they also have Mike Munchak, who is regarded as one of the best offensive line coaches in football. And I think they felt like in order to keep him from entertaining head coaching opportunities that they needed to give him a sizable raise. So they're paying assistant coaches and position coaches probably more than they should. So I think like Munchak is making way more than an offensive line coach. He's probably making somewhere between what an offensive coordinator and a head coach makes.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a quarterback's coach promoted to offensive coordinator who's making coordinator money now. So I think they're doing like this, you know, committee approach, all hands on deck, like everybody's hand in the pile. We're all going to, like, as a village, nurture this guy. But I think he needs more one-on-one care. And, you know, I also wouldn't be surprised if they asked their, like, veteran backup, Landry Jones, who's been here for a while now, to basically make that part of his job description where, like, you know, he's familiar enough with the playbook and what they're trying to do that he has to take more of a hands-on approach with Rudolph.
Andrew, I feel like I still know you well enough to not have to ask you if you watched the All-Star game last night. I'm going to assume that you did at least watch some of the All-Star game. Sal and I both found, I was surprised how much I enjoyed the on-field, in-game interviews with players. What did you think of that?
So, like, whenever I see that, part of me wishes that they could do it during regular games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like you're getting teased by something that totally takes you behind the curtain and in this like ongoing chronic battle to try to make baseball more interesting. You see something like that last night and I don't know, like the first thing that pops into my head is like, crap, like if I knew that they were going to do this every game, you know, maybe it would make baseball more interesting. But then again, I think like, well, maybe if the game actually mattered, the players would just give very like boring answers because they needed to focus on obviously something that was way more important than talking to a play-by-play guy that they probably hate. So I think like in that thing, like one time a year, it adds to it. You know, I've always been of the belief that the baseball All-Star game is the best All-Star game, not because I care about who wins or loses, but I don't care like what's at stake, whether it's a spring training game or whether it's an exhibition game or whether it's a celebrity softball game. Like, I like watching Max Scherzer pitch to Mike Trout. Like,
right.
Could be anywhere on earth. Like, I want to see those one-on-one matchups. So the first two innings of an All-Star game, I really like. Everything after that, I could take or leave. I didn't know who won the game until I got up and checked this morning.
Same here. I totally agree on the first two innings, too. Like, the starters, and I don't know, Buck, the way Buck was talking about Scherzer, I was, like, waiting for Scherzer to turn into the Incredible Hulk or something, the way Buck was, like, he's so dialed in, he's so intense. Like, what are you talking about? He's pitching, like, Jesus. But, like, yeah. once there's a new pitcher every inning, I just sort of, it puts me to sleep. I can't really handle that much. Although it's not that different from a regular game now with how the bullpens are used, but it just once they start rolling
the
new guy
Roberts
out.
The Tampa probably looked at that game and said, "This is a good idea. Let's do this more often."
Right. All right, man. Well, look, nice catching up with you. I'm happy you made the time, and I look forward to talking to you again, and maybe, you know, who knows, someday maybe we'll get to visit with you actually in person sometime.
All right, Bulldog. Sal, good to talk to you too, man.
You too, Andrew. Thank you.
That's it for us. Stay tuned. The nightcap. Joe's had a full day off here with the All-Star game yesterday, so he's raring to go. Stay tuned for that. I'll talk to you tomorrow at 3 here on WGR.
And tomorrow starts the same old thing again.
Gentlemen, be free.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.